It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Nearly 1.5 million Pennsylvanians cast their votes in the June 2nd primary through mail-in ballots, the first election in the state where no-excuse absentee ballots were permitted. Less than 4 weeks later, the Trump campaign sued Pennsylvania Secretary of State Kathy Buchvar and all 67 county election boards. Countersuits were then filed. Emily Previty is a reporter with PA Post. She's been covering elections, new voting machines for counties, the change to the mail-in ballot law, and now lawsuits. Emily, Friday was the deadline to file motions in federal court to dismiss the Trump campaign lawsuit. Has anything come of that request as of now?
No, not yet. I checked the docket this morning and the judge hadn't ruled on those motions yet, and I'm still going through them myself. You can see on the docket that they say that the basis of the motion to dismiss is the failure to state a claim. And the lawsuit does make claims, but, for example, does not go into the detailed narrative that you would typically see for plaintiffs in a case, detailing what about their experiences entail the alleged harm.
The judge has agreed to expedite the case with a hearing September 22nd in Pittsburgh. That doesn't give county elections departments much time if any major changes are made.
No, it doesn't. But we should also note that there could be changes to the election code, and many election officials and fair voting, fair elections advocates say that there should be changes to the election code based on what happened during the primary. Some of these changes had been requested even in advance of the primary. State lawmakers will be looking at making changes to the election code anyway.
The Trump campaign claims the state disenfranchised voters and opened up the opportunity for election fraud this fall. How so?
The president's reelection campaign's attorneys bringing this case say that during the primary, the mail ballot drop boxes were not secure, that they also were not operated in a way that is in line with the state's election code. There were mobile drop boxes in Philadelphia. There were other counties that had located drop boxes at libraries or shopping centers or outside of municipal buildings or county buildings, and Trump campaign's attorneys are saying that the state should only permit, that the court should clarify that voters must mail ballots back to the county election offices or drop them off there in person, that these other types of locations for ballot drop boxes aren't valid, and they want the court to clarify that in a ruling.
And they also want them to arrive by election day, not be postmarked by election day. Is that correct?
Correct. They also want Pennsylvanians to be allowed to be poll watchers anywhere in the state versus only their county of residence.
The state Democratic Party countered with its own suit. This one was filed in state court. Are the plaintiffs here basically asking for the exact opposite of the Trump campaign?
Essentially, they are seeking to maintain the current requirement that poll watchers reside in the county that they're working. They want the court to clarify that counties can come up with their own ballot collection plans and require counties to accept mail-in ballots that are submitted without a secrecy envelope. And they want the court to hold that ballots postmarked by Election Day can be accepted for up to a week after polls close. Now, and that's the same deadline for military and overseas voters, and that is similar to the extension afforded to a handful of counties during the primary in June.
Emily, there are some other lawsuits brought by disability rights organizations. What are they seeking?
So the National Federation of the Blind of Pennsylvania is seeking a way for voters who are visually impaired to complete more of the voting process at home rather than having to go to the polls and contend with the health risks, potential exposure to coronavirus. And they were actually successful in getting preliminary injunction in advance of the primary so that certain voters, specifically those visually impaired voters who had already requested and been approved for an absentee or mail-in ballot, could do more of the process from home with this sort of interim fix. You know, it's hard to say exactly how that suit will proceed, but we know that the Department of State has been working on more broadly a new system for voters who are visually impaired to be in place in advance of the general election.
One of the other suits involves the NAACP. What is that organization seeking?
That lawsuit is seeking an injunction that would require state election officials to increase the number of polling places and provide more notice if polling places are going to be consolidated or moved. The temporary rules that were passed in advance of this year's primary were meant to afford more flexibility in moving and consolidating polling places, since it had to be done on an expedited schedule amid the pandemic. It did not require the same notification that is typically required when election officials are moving polling places. So voters did not have to be directly notified by mail, and there did not have to be signs at the polling place itself. Many counties did that anyway, but the lawsuit is, I think, looking to require that across the board so all voters get that direct notification.
Emily Previty is a reporter for PA Post. Thanks, Emily.
Thank you, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In 2016, then-candidate Donald Trump won Pennsylvania by 44,292 votes out of more than 6 million cast. That's a difference of 0.72%, the narrowest margin in a presidential election in our state since 1840, when William Henry Harrison defeated Martin Van Buren by just 0.12%. Trump's slender margin of victory was due in thanks largely to a surge in support from white voters, specifically voters who don't have a college degree. But WHYY's Katie Meyer reports that group of voters is steadily shrinking, and demographic data shows that if Trump wants to win Pennsylvania again, his coalition needs to expand.
It's a pattern that's been going on in key swing states like Pennsylvania for years. As numbers of white voters, in particular white voters who don't have a college degree, decline, Latino, Black, and Asian voters make up an increasing share of the voter base. Roy Teixeira, a fellow at liberal-leaning think tank the Center for American Progress, has been watching the trend for years. He says it's a stark difference in Pennsylvania.
If everything remains the same in 2020 as it was in 2016, of course it won't, but in terms of turnout patterns and support levels among all these different demographic groups, just that much demographic change would be enough to tip the election to the Democrats.
A few numbers are especially telling. 4 years ago, Trump swung three counties from blue to red, Erie, Northampton, and Luzerne. White voters drove that result. But since 2016, all three counties have seen contractions in their white populations, while other groups, especially Latino people, have grown. Tim Schock, a demographer at the Pennsylvania State Data Center, notes Latino residents shot up by 26% in Luzerne County.
It's pretty dramatic. We don't always see changes like that occurring.
Those changes are also dramatic on the ground. Amilcar Arroyo was originally from Peru and has lived in Hazleton in Luzerne County for more than 30 years. He publishes the city's monthly Spanish-language newspaper to serve its rapidly growing Latino population. Arroyo says as more people moved in, some white residents felt threatened. The tension culminated in then-Republican Mayor Lou Barletta unsuccessfully trying to bar undocumented immigrants from renting and holding jobs in Hazleton. Arroyo thinks that period, from 2006 to 2008, was the worst time in Hazleton for Latino people. Things are better now, but he thinks President Trump's immigration rhetoric feels familiar.
What is going on in the United States at this time, we suffered that discrimination and racism in 2006, 2007, 2008.
Unlike the rest of Luzerne County, Hazleton voted against Trump 4 years ago. Arroyo, and many analysts, have observed that if turnout gets higher among Latino voters, they could have a major impact on how states like Pennsylvania swing. For now, those numbers are still relatively low. But Arroyo, for one, is confident more Latino voters will turn out with time, for a very specific reason.
We love this country, believe me. That is for sure.
Katie Meyer in Philadelphia.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh is home to several institutions that don't just teach students, but also conduct research that's used around the globe. Labs had to shut down earlier in the pandemic. Now that we're getting closer to the fall semester, universities need to figure out how to get students and researchers safely back on campus. The Confluence's Mary Lee Williams spoke with Michael McQuaid, Vice President for Research at Carnegie Mellon University.
CMU says they have three phases. And phase one was when you had pilot research labs. Can you tell me, how were those labs chosen? And can you give me an example of one of those labs?
Each of the laboratories that has resumed operation on campus has had to develop a very specific plan as to how that will happen. That plan takes into account density in the laboratories. It takes into account movement of people in and out of buildings. It takes into account what protective equipment people are going to have, what rules they will have so that we don't have density beyond what we should and we can enforce physical distancing, et cetera. The prioritization process is broad from across the university. It comes from the college level, so the dean's level have a set of priorities. Those priorities might include graduate student progression on degrees. They might include progress against milestones that a particular sponsor has for us. One of the projects that we allowed to come back quite early in the process was a project at the National Robotics Engineering Center, where we have a long-term contract with the Army Corps of Engineers. It's developing a very large robot. This is sort of 50 feet kind of scale robot, which will mount on a barge and work on the Mississippi River to stabilize the bank of the river against erosion and flood conditions. So that project had done a tremendous amount of work off-site, programming work in particular, but the need to get back and actually have that work happen on the robot in the facility was an early prioritization for us.
On CMU's website, it says that you're now currently in phase two. Can you give me an overview of how the first phase with the pilot research labs went?
So far, so good. And I don't mean because we're still in phase one, phase two. It's a bit more continuous on the research side with that. So just to give you some numbers, we have about 120 specific laboratories that have been authorized to come back to campus. Roughly a little bit over 1,100 people that have been authorized in the research portfolio. Again, we're still in that category of research that has a requirement to be on campus as opposed to it would be nice to just be on campus. How's it going? Every week, each of those laboratories delivers a report through my office. Uniformly, the attention to detail has been spectacular. I expected it to be good, knowing the quality of the people. It's been even better than I expected. So the adherence to the rules of the road, if you will, has been quite good.
When we're talking about the physical sciences, when we're talking about biology or animal sciences, they use living organisms. They use microbes. They use maybe mice or other animals. At the beginning, when Carnegie Mellon shut down, how did your institution handle keeping these organisms alive?
We made the decision roughly third week in March that we had to shut down all operations that were happening, like research operations happening in our campus facilities. And so we established a procedure where authorized users with appropriate pandemic safety precautions, masks, distancing, recording who came in where and when, had been able to come onto campus for limited periods of time to do what they had to do. So that might be taking care of the biological samples, that might be maintaining certain temperature conditions, et cetera.
Was there a lot of pivoting that was necessary when it came to not just keeping people safe, but saying, okay, now we have the facilities to do this work?
Some of it was what you might think of as an easy pivot. People already working on biodetection modules or people already working on early stage precursors to pharmaceuticals, to be able to transition those specifically to the COVID virus is a pretty straightforward process. But we also had people in, for example, in our, we have some substantial laboratories that are devoted to additive manufacturing, sort of modern 3D printing technologies. They're used for a whole variety of reasons, as you can imagine, across the whole research portfolio. But several of those laboratories were converted over into laboratories looking at specialty manufacturing methods to supply personal protective equipment for the frontline healthcare workers. So all of this is in the category of what we did right at the beginning. And then once we got more comfortable with both the progression of the virus in the Western Pennsylvania area, Southwestern Pennsylvania area, then we moved to a broader process of allowing research, not just COVID-specific research, but to begin to allow much more of the research that needed to be done in facilities back to campus. And that's sort of the stage we're in right now.
Cases are rising in Southwestern Pennsylvania, particularly in Allegheny County. I'm wondering, since the cases are on the rise again, what is your threshold to start reversing course, to pulling people back?
So we don't have a numerical threshold that we're operating against. If we have this many cases, we'll make this decision just yet, because we've proven that we can actually operate under a set of conditions that provide a certain amount of safety to us. So we'll make those decisions in real time. And it's also not just a research decision. Those decisions will be integrated with everything else that happens on campus. So every day we're going to look at the results. Every day we're going to look at how people are doing. Every day we're going to look at what the local caseloads are, and we'll make the decisions that are warranted at each particular day. And if it means certain areas have to move off back off campus as opposed to the whole campus, my guess is we'll be a little bit more tactical this time than when we first in March just did a blanket move everybody off campus at one time.
How does the university plan to cope with lost time for in-person research? Some research grants or, you know, charters or donations for certain types of research have a certain time limit on it. So how are you coping with the lost time?
In the late February, early March timeframe, I was very worried about that. And it's proven to be, at least for right now, not as big an issue as I might have worried. Those research programs that are up against tight timeframes, first of all, over the period of time when nothing was specifically on campus, most of our research teams were able to shift the sort of short-term priorities. Research, even research that has to be in a physical space, oftentimes has desk work, computer work, literature work, writing. There have been some cases where we worry a little bit about long-term attention schedule, but so far that hasn't been really an issue for us. And those kind of schedule things have factored into the prioritization with which we're beginning to bring the physical research back to campus. But long-winded way of saying, so far has not been a major problem for us.
That's Michael McQuaid, Vice President for Research at Carnegie Mellon University, speaking with The Confluence's Mary Lee Williams. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. If you enjoy what you're hearing, there's even more to read on our website at WESA.fm, where our newsroom is rounding up everything you need to know about how the coronavirus pandemic is affecting our region and beyond. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at WESA.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Helen Wigger, Tom Hurley, Julia Zenkovich, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.